Welcome, everyone. I've realized it's been probably a few episodes now since I've introduced myself. My name is Eric Jorgensen. I'm the host of the ABCs of Disability Planning podcast. I do this podcast to introduce listeners, you, to organizations, resources, and services that you may have never heard of, or you have heard of them, but you were never really quite sure how they might come into play with your life. Today's conversation is a little bit different. I learned about John Lepke from an article he had written. It was an opinion article for the CBC, and it was, "Let us be boring, disabled people are more than heroes or objects of your pity," and it's part of a longer series titled Taking a Sitting Stand. John is a disabled journalist based in Saskatoon, Canada. He happens to be a wheelchair user. He was a parasport athlete. And we just have a really roaming conversation. He'll say quite a few times, you know, he admits that he was rambling. I'm going to leave that in there. I want to leave all the gaps, the false starts. I want to leave it all in there because I feel like it was a very honest conversation. I want to honor him and his disability. I want to honor my ignorance and the change. You know, I feel like I took away quite a bit there. I like having conversations like these with people with disabilities because I feel like it makes me better and it makes all of us better if we're willing to really sit with what perceptions may we have that may not be the full story. You know, for me specifically, it was, I've kind of been beating this drum that I don't want to see the autism community usurp the legislative process. You know, I'm afraid that we're going to see a lot of bills being passed specifying what they're going to do for people with autism and on the spectrum. That's a little short-sighted because my son's on the spectrum. These things are going to benefit my son. They're going to benefit so many people when you consider 1 in 44 people are being diagnosed. So I need to reframe, and I'm working on a reframe. And the conversation with John helped me realize that I need to reframe. I don't know what that reframe looks like yet. I'm a work in progress. I think many of us are. But I think you'll enjoy this conversation. I would ask you to consider sharing, subscribing, leaving a comment, review, if you're so moved. It really helps me make a better show. With that said, let's dive in. Welcome, everyone. Today, I'm interviewing, I'm hoping I'm saying this right, Saskatoon-based journalist, John Lepke. John and I are going to have a conversation about inspiration porn and, you know, just the, well, I'm going to read a direct quote from an article that I reached out to John after reading, and I quote, "Media coverage often caricatures us as overcoming or confined, a champion or a victim." And I love that quote because I feel like it ties into this frustration I have where people have to have superpowers or they're differently abled, or it just drives me nuts. I mean, what's wrong
whatever
with
saying, euphemism they want to add, right?
Yes. What's wrong with just saying I happen to have a disability? It's not who I am. It's just no different than your brown hair, right? I mean,
well, yeah, and I think, like, now coming at this for context for your listeners, like, I have multiple disabilities, but let's just say my main one I have had from birth. You know, on the article that you referenced talks a lot about parasport. On the parasport forms, I used to be the pain in the ass who would write, you know, they would write, those forms always had onset of injury, and I would always put -6 months, because of course they're written for SCI folks, which is fine. I'm not making fun of them, but I would drive the leaders of these organizations sort of wild with my affect. So point being, you know, it is a key part of who I am. I can't separate it, and I'm very identity first. I mean, my Twitter bio says crippled and creative. My politics are not hidden. However, I think the narrative, I wrote about this a couple of years ago as well, that we see this hero versus villain narrative play out in other ways. For example, with COVID and healthcare, this celebrating our heroes for healthcare. But did that result in any additional funding? Do we have any less attrition in the medical sector from nurses and doctors and researchers? No, it's an empty thing. Because I and maybe I'm going out on a limb for some of your listeners, but you know, you speak of inspiration porn, and I reference Stella Young in the piece, one of our renowned activists who we have lost over the course of the last few years. But, you know, a poster of, say, a double amputee child running, right, with the slogan, like, where's your excuse? Well, my excuse is chronic pain. Yeah. And I guarantee you that, I mean, I don't know that person. I do have a remarkable ability to end up knowing people who end up on the news as a former parasport athlete. You know, somebody be like, do you know that person? You have to be like, yes. Like, whoops. Actually, I do. We played sports together, or, you know, we were at a similar tournament or whatever, right? That community is remarkably small, even as large as it is. But, like, you know, if I talk to my, you know, if I talk to some of those track athletes, they're not going to, they're not going to judge me for what I can and can't do in that sporting arena. And it's very silly for us to label everybody with these, you know, these labels. Now, I'm going to take some advice that I was given early on in life, which I use all the time. Are you using the label, or is the label using you? Right. I think we get caught up in, you know, I'm not a parent, but I know some of you, you know, it's a lot of your listeners and a lot of your work. Like, we get very caught up in labels and, oh, my kid's going to be titled as disabled. That's going to hold them back. Right. But if you need to fill that out in a form so that they get an EA, I don't know if it's a similar term in the US. I can't remember it. Educational assistant, like a support in the classroom.
Like a one-on-one or a, yeah.
Yeah. If they need it for their IEP or, IDEA funding, that label is semi-meaningless. I mean, in the U.S. and in Canada, you know, all of these programs have different names. You know, special needs. Do I like the term? Not particularly. Does it stop me from coming on to a podcast to talk about it? Not particularly. I think we can very easily get ourselves caught up in the words that we use. And I'm an English major and a journalist. I like words, but I don't necessarily like the sort of pigeonholing that we end up in. And, you know, the example that I give often, it didn't make it into that piece, but it's made it into others, is, you know, there's often this argument about identity first versus person first. I'm quite identity first. You ask me 10 years ago, I'm probably very person first. If you ask the average parasport athlete, even at that elite level, they're probably going to say person first, because all of the marketing around parasport is person first, person first, person first.
Can you explain the difference real quick for anybody that doesn't
know? Yeah, of course. So identity first, for example, would be disabled person. And then person first would be person with a disability. And part of an addendum to this is that partially through sort of loss of disability history or lack of teaching, a lot of people don't realize that person first was developed or was brought into the consciousness from intellectually and developmentally disabled advocates and their support systems. And now it's become code in certain circles for, that person doesn't align with my politics. And I mean, we could go on and on forever about how intellectually and developmentally disabled people have been left behind by, if we can call them, mainstream disability advocacy.
Yeah.
But it all sort of ties into the same machine for me in terms of, you know, whether you're a hero or a villain. And as I say in the piece, unfortunately, we don't get to be boring. Apparently, I'm inspirational for getting up in the morning to some people. And that's not to say that disabled people can't be inspirational. You know, if I look at former teammates, I'll pick Pat Anderson. I'm sure he's not a teammate, but somebody, you know, probably it's fairly easy to say, like, the world's best wheelchair basketball player ever. And maybe I'm biased, he's Canadian. There's a couple people who could vie for that title. You know, he's inspirational or Chantal Benoit is another one. They're inspirational to me because they played into their 40s and Pat's in his 40s. Chantal played to 50-something on a national team. They're inspirational to me. They're not inspirational to me because they're amputees or you know, have other disabilities. Like, Pat's origin story, if you can call it that, doesn't, you know, that's not why he's inspirational to me. But we have to get to a point where we can get from that barrier, or, you know, it's not that the story can't be interesting. You know, CP athlete, CP public speaking, there is an inspirational aspect to me in that sort of relational way, but it's not inspirational from a sort of very generic, oh, he's a hero because he got out of bed. you know.
No, to me, I think
you can bleep this if you want, but there are a lot of disabled people who are assholes who I don't want to share space with.
Yes.
And
yes.
that's okay. Right?
Yes, I mean,
and it doesn't give us space to admit that when we're all heroes and we're all wonderful and
It's like from my community as a veteran, hearing that every veteran's a hero. No, you know how many of them just freaking they're not. You know, that's not how it works. And you know, for me, when I see somebody, for somebody to be inspirational, it has to be something that I want to. That would motivate me to be like, dang, if they can do it, I want to figure out what I can learn from them. You know, when you have a high school football team giving somebody with Down syndrome the football and then standing out of the way so we can score a touchdown, that's not inspiration to me. That's like pedantic. I mean, it's so freaking.
And I think part of this is that people are never, I shouldn't say never. Hardly ever are the disabled people involved. You know, I think of like these prom every year, prom season. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of an American thing. Not that Canadians don't do it, but there's less of a pomp and circumstance, I think, up here around prom. But, you know, these sort of like, isn't it so nice that they took a disabled person to prom? And it's like, quite often, when you dig into an article that's done well and informed, you find out that they've been friends for 6 years. And this was sort of like, sure, that, you know, they might not be romantically involved, but they certainly weren't asking for giant pomp and circumstance and media to show up and be like, isn't it nice that you like the disabled person? You know, we reinforce our biases when we do that. I can't speak to the veterans, although, you know, the piece that you referenced does talk a lot about parasport, and parasport is inherently tied to, you know, rehabilitation for veterans. And, you know, I could very easily drag us off course with that. But, you know, I think when we look at people as just heroes or just sad little cripples in corners, using a reclaimed word there, we don't allow people to be full humans. We're caricatures. And, you know, I mentioned there are lots of people who, you know, perhaps I wouldn't get along with. I'm sure I can guarantee, given who I was as an athlete, a bit of a loud, brash, annoying person who wasn't that talented, that I'm that person for some people. And that's fine by me, because that's called being human.
I mean, the reality is that at least 50% of the people in the world aren't going to like you, right? I mean, that's just odds. Right? I mean...
Yeah, or they, you know, they see the odd side of me. You know, I played, particularly after wheelchair basketball, I went to wheelchair rugby for a bit. And I was quite brash, despite not knowing what I would do. So wheelchair rugby, it's an odd cross between about four different sports. But anyway, in wheelchair basketball, I'm a class two, which is lower end of the scale. Low classes tend to joke, you know, we're low class in more ways than one. In wheelchair rugby, I was 3.5 on a 3.5 scale.
Wow.
And so I jokingly used to call myself a puppet with function in that way, because I had teammates who were on the national team. They were telling me where to go, right? But my brain hadn't figured out that I didn't know what I was doing. So anyway, I would have people come up to me afterwards and go, oh, it's really nice to talk to you, because if I only went on the court, your on-court persona, I would not want to know you, right? And again, we struggle to create space for that when we fall back into this heroes and pity parties, as they put it.
So how do we get around that? I mean, it's at the national. I mean, it seems like it's in everything I read. Everything, you know, I don't watch a lot of TV, but it just seems like the TV I do watch, there's not a lot of disability representation. So how do we start getting around this?
I mean, I think it depends on, I mean, it's funny to say, it depends on how your brain works. it depends. Like, if you are looking for media representation, Dominic Evans runs a thing called Film Dis, where him and some others do some, what do I call it? Like, they study film and TV representation and put out what is essentially a white paper.
Oh, wow.
On it. Certainly, you know, academic circles. But when I say how the brain works, it's also like, what relationship do you have to disability community? Not you specifically, Eric. I think I'm fairly aware of that. But, you know, if you are if you are coaching a parasport team, then there's a certain set of politics, right? This idea that, or a certain language, right? There's a language in everything that we do, and you learn the language. And I think, well, what needs to become a little bit more commonplace is understanding that, like, if I walk into a parasport space, most parasports that I've been a part of, and I've been a part of about five, although two of them enough to make it into my bio. I did wheelchair track. I have a silver medal. The funny joke about that is that there were only two competitors in the race that I won a medal in. So it's not exactly. And the people were paying so little attention that they thought I won gold. If I walk in there, like, I'm not special in any way of the words. But, and I don't say this story complimentarily, because certainly to some people this would be offensive, but I remember at an early wheelchair rugby tournament, because I went to it after basketball, I stood up to grab something because I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user, and about 150 people who knew me, because they just knew people around me, but I didn't know them particularly personally, started singing Faker, Faker, Faker in a hotel lobby. I mean, I can see how that is a negative thing. And certainly I would have yelled at them if I felt aggrieved. And certainly I wouldn't say to do that to a younger athlete or somebody who doesn't know the context or whatever. But, you know, that's kind of the environment that I was in. You know, it's the difference between, oh, you know, he's a person who has cerebral palsy, to go, oh, he's a spaz. Right. And that not being a value judgment. Now, do I recommend that for everything? No. I think that's like when you're in a team with other disabled people and you know the language and you know what people are okay with, right? And don't prescribe it to new athletes either, because certainly people come to it with different thoughts, right? Versus, you know, I'm more likely to use person first language to refer to other people when I'm in, say, a university setting that's just understanding IDEA, meaning in conjunction with DEI. I don't mean in terms of the legislation. Aren't all these acronyms fun? You know, it's about code switching, and to me, and it's about understanding how different expectations are. You know, if that, I mean, I point to articles all the time. If that article was for primarily just disabled people, certainly part of the audience, then the wording would be different, and that's fine. You know, certainly representation. I mean, my job before journalist, and I still do some work with them, is a disability arts nonprofit. So I certainly think representation is a huge barrier within the arts to disabled population. And I think lateral ableism is a significant issue. Lateral ableism being ableism that disabled people can levy at other disabled people, sort of our preconceived notions of disabled people. Sort of the best example would be, like, if you are, like for me, if I have cerebral palsy and I've had it from birth, I've gone through all these advocacy things, I come from a medical family, blah, 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 blah. And then I see another person with, let's just pick a disability somewhat different, but somewhat similar to mine, somebody with MS, and I go, well, why can't they just do it the way I did it? And, right. Oh, this disabled person has all of these, they can do all of these things. What are they doing about it? That's a version of lateral ableism. I certainly think that those conversations need to be had, particularly in the intersection. And sorry, I'm rambling for you a bit now, Eric, but especially in the intersection between physically disabled folks and I say, you know, primarily because I think we're coming to more of an understanding. I have mental health disabilities as well. I think we're starting to come to more of an understanding about that interplay. But again, the interplay between intellectually, developmentally disabled people and folks with physical disabilities and disabilities like my own, which I have cerebral palsy, which, you know, technically falls into both categories. It's technically a traumatic brain injury, although I tend not to use that label unless it is, you know, exceedingly relevant, because it's not the TBI story of, you know, I got it in a car crash or had it from childhood trauma or whatever. It's
in the States cerebral palsy is classified as a developmental disability. It falls under the IDD umbrella,
which I don't know my technicalities too much in terms of, you know, I don't want to prescribe how Canada views it, because I moved here when I was 11, so I was from Britain, so I was well well and truly secure in my crippledom. I think I'm going to win the award for guest of yours that says crippled the most times, Eric.
Certainly the only guest so far.
Well, you're welcome. No, I don't think if you ask the average person, if you said, is CP a physical disability, an IDD disability, a cognitive disability, because it can fit in all three buckets, depending on, you know, manifestations. I don't think all that many people outside of people who are sort of in the know, quote unquote, would put it in the IDD bucket. And I think we have a certain prescription of what intellectual and developmental disability looks like. Not my community, so I don't want to speak for anybody, but we certainly see that conversation happen a heck of a lot with, on, say, autism Twitter about where do we put it? Sometimes that, like I said, sometimes those buckets and those boxes are helpful, especially to get support needs that people may want or require. But I think there's a difference.
Yeah, autism's another hot button for me because, and I'm speaking as the father of a child who, he's an adult who has intellectual disabilities and autism diagnosed, and some mental health challenges we're working on. Oh, but my challenge with the autism community at large, and it may not even be the community, it may just be their advocates, is I'm worried that as you get this one disability bending the ear of legislation for funding, laws are going to get written specifically for that disability, when a lot of those same laws could benefit a much larger audience.
Mm.
Like,
I so again, not my community, so I don't want to like speak on things that I know not of. I do have a sibling who's autistic, but I don't think that gives me the right to take mics away from autistic people, first of all, and then parents of autistic children either. What I will say is that regardless of disability, I think we need to work from a space of solidarity and to understand that I have CP. I'm only from now coming to understand myself under the neurodivergent umbrella. That comes from my, as one of my friends would put it, my autistic kin. I think it requires solidarity on both sides. And if there are more than two sides to this, I think. And my argument would be that we've seen this before. I think these disability legislation, and again, not my expertise particularly, you'd have to go to others for this, but I would argue that, like, so I'm 29. When I was in late elementary school and high school, we were sort of litigating, not in the true like legal sense, but we were as a community arguing over whether folks with ADD and ADHD got to fit under the umbrella.
Yep.
I would argue now we're arguing, broadly speaking, I'm not arguing. I think the umbrella fits people who belong under it. I think self-diagnosis is valid. I am one of those people. Again, crippled and creative in the Twitter bio. I think now we're starting to understand and breaking down the barriers for chronically ill people long COVID, but long before that, conversations around disability that are outside of the sort of I have arthritis, chronically ill, and more towards the I have ME, CFS, that sort of same to chronic illness. And I think and I've said this to some people, I think the next, I don't know if frontier is the right term, but, you know, addictions counts as a disability under the ADA, it counts under the Canadian, counts as a bit of a loaded term, but it counts under the Canadian Human Rights Framework. I believe it also counts under the British Equality Act, although you have to fact check me on that. You'd have to go look at Liam O'Dell and others who have done much more work around this as journalists. I think that's our next thing where we need to have deeper conversations around that intersection, because again, it's certainly, that experience is certainly disabling. And so I'm hesitant to, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but I'm hesitant to pin it on, you know, one activism group. But again, if folks at CP had the we're bending the ear, so to speak, then I might think something different. But I just think, and part of that is I'm biased in a way in that I think we don't know enough of our disability history.
Yeah.
And I think that really hamstrings us in this. Yeah. And we have, you know, we have people, you know, here and there, you know, the people who've served in, I say served to a veteran, but worked, you know, independent living centers. And we still have people around who are disabled who have been working these gigs since their inception, yeah, right? Or close to, you know, those are the people that we need to look at and ask about how to, and sometimes challenge the assumptions of some of those people as well about how do we build, again, I mean, look at the history of spinal cord injury advocacy, yeah, being for 50 years, we got to get them back to normal.
Right. Right.
And there was a heck of a lot of shift. I mean,
right,
wheelchair basketball didn't allow, you know, disabilities that weren't spinal cord injuries to class in, as in be able to play, for a very long time. Right. This is, we have these sort of discussions over and over, and I think we just need to evolve. And certainly that's an external thing that the world needs to mold around, but I also think it's a difficult set of conversations to have within community and with allies.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, John, because it does help me take a step back and look at the scene from a, you know, a wider lens, right? Is the reason I'm so beating the drum, but because I live in the autism world, and that's why I want to have conversations like this, because I don't want to be in an echo chamber where people are just, you know, mirroring whatever I happen to be saying. So no, I mean, I appreciate.
Well, if you wanted an echo chamber, you came to the wrong person.
But I really appreciate this conversation. I mean, it's, you know, and as you were talking, it brings to mind, I didn't know that about the wheelchair, about wheelchair basketball, you know, and I recently learned that there are states that still don't allow organ transplants for individuals with disabilities. And, you know, and it's horrifying to me that we're in the 21st century. We're creating a metaverse where, in theory, we have the opportunity to create a truly equitable world, you know, virtual or otherwise. And yet we still have these barbaric, I don't know another word for it, right? I mean, you have Dick Cheney in his 70s getting a heart transplant, but we couldn't give a heart transplant to a 19-year-old who has Down syndrome? Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I mean...
Well, you know, insert joke about the pains of capitalism there. Yeah, and I may have just mixed wheelchair basketball and wheelchair rugby, but anyway, Paraspartan classification has a long history of allowing and disallowing. I mean, we still see it, right? I forget the athlete's name, but British who... Some folks with chronic regional pain syndrome were classed out wheelchair basketball. And he said, oh, I guess I should have got my leg cut off when they asked me if I could have, right? We see this in parasport Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is starting to become understood as more common than previously thought, because it's going through the thing that certainly autism went through for a long time and still is going through. I don't want to mitigate. It's not like, woohoo, everything's fixed in terms of underdiagnosis within certain, you know, populations. I think that there is just a continued lack of understanding. And I think that oftentimes within certain disability groups, there are people who are handed the mic. And quite often the people who are handed the mic are not the disabled people. They are the disabled person's parents. I'm not making a comment on your experience, obviously, but parents, caregivers, quote unquote allies. And, you know, I see this in social media now. I don't know how I would have grown up, probably differently, if, like, I was suddenly, like, the face of content creation for, like, CP. I mean, in a way, like, I was interviewed about it. I was one of the first kids to have Botox stabbed into my heel cord tendons in the UK. It works. I mean, it's a regular thing now. You know, there are lots of things in which we have this conversation, but I think social media has amplified that, certainly given voices to a heck of a lot more disabled people than previously. But I think it has also created this ecosystem of who gets the mic. And before, that was a default, right? The default was that it was going to go to parent, doctor, or caregiver, whatever. And now disabled people are disrupting that. And so the question is how to find comfort and do that equitably. And I think the average activist would say, you know, talk to the people affected and also keep in mind your own lived experience. For example, if I give advice to somebody and the person they're supporting uses, I don't know what the technical term is, sip and puff wheelchair, I'm not going to give them useful advice on transferring. I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user. What am I doing giving that advice? Right. I can give them advice on like, here's how to handle, here's the conversations you might want to have with an IEP from lived experience, or, you know, how do you handle, so I did it badly, how do you handle anxiety that can often come along with CP and other disabilities? You know, yada, yada, yada. I can give a coherent argument for why life expectancy data for quads is so bad, right? Like, these are things that I can give, but we can't prescribe like, oh, I'm suddenly the voice of disability. And I think that's where we get lost.
I appreciate that, John. I think what I would like to see, and I don't know how to do it. So I'm speaking as a parent, I can't speak for all parents, but I do, you know, I know there have been periods in my life where I've underestimated my son or just haven't allowed him the opportunity to succeed or fail. You know, I've wanted to protect him. And I think that's inherent in being a parent to some degree. But I what I'd like to see would be more people being willing to listen to opinions that are different than their own, or maybe they don't have an opinion and just, you know, go out and try to find content like, you know, like what we're doing right now, right? I mean,
yep.
Unfortunately, the self-selection for this audience is going to probably be individuals who have disabilities or children with disabilities. It's probably not going to be somebody who's writing laws or making proposals who doesn't happen to have a disability or is connected to the IDD community. I'd like to see that change somehow.
I think there's, this is anecdotal, but I think there are a fair number of people within, maybe not this job title specifically, but ADA coordinators and et cetera, who perhaps don't identify with the label, or not to complicate things for you, Eric, but like the, you know, when we talk about anxiety and depression, I think the ongoing pandemic, because it is ongoing, has highlighted for people the fact that when they had a moment to sit with themselves, not to therapize this too much, began to see themselves within disability community. And I think that was complicated for the disability community, particularly in long COVID, because had to undo all those perceptions of like, well, you're disabled, all your tax gets taken care of, or you're disabled, of course you get support, or this thing isn't researched enough. Well, CP doesn't get researched enough because it is perceived of as a childhood disability, and surprise, we become adults. And those conversations that are being had and need to happen, and disability community on the flip side of that needing to unpack the fact that we can't expect people just coming to the identity to have, you know, 20 years of lived experience, which that's not reasonable. We don't expect it, I hope, of, you know, teens who are coming to themselves to understand themselves as politically disabled, like disability as a political identity. So why should we expect it of somebody who realizes they have long COVID at 45? Right? Like, why? But I do think that more and more people are seeing themselves alongside that, to use an overused term, spectrum. And the question is whether people feel comfortable identifying.
And right? I like that.
Does it benefit them?
Yeah. And you know, John, I think, I don't know if I think I shared this with you, but like, I'm, according to the VA, I'm 90% disabled, but I don't identify as having a disability. Because, well, first, I feel like there's a lot of negative connotations to having a disability. And I say this acknowledging I'm talking to a person with a disability, but
that's okay. I'm fine.
You know, it's something.
It's not all swings and roundabouts.
it's just not my, I guess there's a, and I'm struggling here because I've never really talked it out with anybody, but I think there's another part of me that it just feels disingenuous because I don't have it that bad, right? I mean, and I don't even know what that means because, like I said, John, I've never really talked this out. I'm just, you know.
I understand. And we certainly don't have to talk about it. And the luck of editing is that you get to cut it out if you don't want to talk about it.
I think I'm going to leave it in because I think people need to see how hard this conversation is.
Yeah, I mean, this, I'm always reminded of the invisible disability thing, right? Like, I come to you now, I'm sitting in a desk chair. If my back was really bad today, I would be sitting in my wheelchair because it gives me better back support. But otherwise, it's not immediately obvious unless I spasm kick my desk and throw a microphone off the table and I tell you about it, that I have a physical disability. I'm quite public about my mental health because I said it on radio. Trust me to come out publicly on radio. Yeah, John's not very good at doing things the easy way. You know, there are days where CP is my most disabling condition. Bar none. I mean, it's minus 58 Fahrenheit outside today in the city where I live. I might have warmed up to a balmy minus 49 Fahrenheit when I looked last time. With wind chill. Guess what? A muscular brain disorder, disability, whatever we want to label CP as, I guess it's not technically a disorder, just not like, you know, minus 45 C. But there are far more days where my anxiety, panic disorder, chronic, I was called elongated depression, that's not the actual term, but it feels elongated to me, is my most disabling thing. And I think it's very easy to lay the oppression Olympics when we don't want to, right? This, like, I have it worse, or the inverse, they have it worse, I have it worse, can sometimes be more dangerous, because in a lot of ways it's a race to the bottom. Not that we don't need to have those conversations, I think we do, but do I need to clarify what oppression Olympics is? I just realized.
I said maybe, but I don't, I mean.
Sure. Oppression Olympics is just like the trap that we can fall into sometimes, where we fall into like, who has it
yeah.
the worst?
And I feel like parents are used to that, because I think I left social media where I'm not an active user because I got so tired of being in these Facebook groups, and it was just this pity party. I mean, it's just, and that's not all Facebook groups, and I get that, and it just, I just
yeah. I think there's like, I used to joke that I had one day a year where I was allowed to feel sad for myself, and I don't prescribe that to anybody anymore, actually. I used to say, you know, give yourself a day or a few days or whatever, but realistically there are days where I super miss out on things, and I need to honor those emotions. What I have to be careful for, and again, this is me just talking personally, is I have to be careful that it doesn't envelop my whole experience, right? Like, I see somebody going and doing something and I'm like, oh, you know, if I wasn't disabled, I'd get to do that. You know, I have a former teammate who used to say, you know, well, you know, I'm disabled, but it's opened more doors than it's closed. And yet still, right, there's like things that that person can't do that, you know, weigh on them, I'm sure. But it's, we often minimize, I think, for the sake of our own survival within community and outside of, regardless of whether you take the label, regardless of what the 90% says or not, because what does that mean? I'm probably 400% disabled some days, not to minimize whatever, you know, but it goes back to the medical model of,
right,
of how we view,
right,
disability. You know, I think that it's important, and this is not me prescribing it to you, or not, Lord knows, I'm not a therapist, but I think we have to honor that for ourselves. Like, it took a very long time for me to identify as neurodivergent. I still struggle with it in a lot of ways. Partially because I've been surrounded by, you know, I've been lucky to be surrounded by a lot of autistic people in my life, including a sibling. And so it didn't, like, I made that false connection, which I think many of us do, that neurodivergence equals autism. And like, that's, yep, the only way you can be neurodivergent. That didn't quite, you know, the boom of understanding ADHD and ADD within neurodiversity. For me, it's just how CP tends to manifest. For me, you know, I think we need to, or if we can, honor those moments for ourselves to say, yeah, sure, that person has a really hard day, regardless of if, you know, however I'm connected to them. But I feel really damn disabled right now. And like, I really wish I could go and do that thing. Or it'd be a heck of a lot easier if the crip tax, the extra costs that come with being disabled, weren't a part of my life. And sure, I can shelve that for, in the same way, you know, if somebody's having an emergency and you shelve your own emotions to go help them. But I don't think it's necessarily, not that everybody has to identify with disability, but I think that's often the barrier of being able to acknowledge it for ourselves. Certainly was for me.
No, I appreciate that, John. I really do. And I appreciate, I just realized what time it was. And I appreciate the time you've taken, man. I want to have more of these conversations where it's not me going into it with a, this is what I want to get out of the conversation. I came into this because I really wanted to learn, and I feel like I have.
I'm glad.
You know,
and I have extra time if you want to go along. That's fine.
No, I may have you back on. I may have you back on because this has been, I've loved this. I've really enjoyed this conversation. This has been awesome.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What do you think, within your audience, because maybe I can provide some insight, what do you think is the biggest barrier when it comes to the disability label? Like, I see you doing some work around, like, consulting around, I mean, maybe that's not the term you use, but consulting around finding supports and navigating systems and whatever. Like, what do you think the biggest barrier is that this podcast is trying to take down with a hammer?
This podcast is trying to help people understand what's available. Because when my wife died and I became a single dad, I didn't even know where to look. And what it felt like to me, and still feels like, you know, 11 years later, is everybody is waiting for me to tell them what I need. I don't know what I need. I don't know what's, the analogy I use is it's like taking me to a restaurant, blindfolding me, and asking me what I want from the menu, but I don't even know what freaking restaurant I'm at. So what I'm hoping to do with this podcast is introduce people to as many different organizations, as many different ideas, as many different opportunities as I can, so they can decide for themselves, this would really work with me or my child. You know, in conversations like this is more for my fellow parents who are like, how do we, you know, what are the conversations we should be having? You know,
sure. So I think the advice that I would give then, if I can get on my unstable soapbox once again, so I don't have very much balance, is that within certain disability structures, I think it's fairly self-explanatory where to go for sort of eldership. But I think we don't have elders in the same way that some marginalized communities do, because there is, I mean, my joke, maybe I made it earlier, I can't remember, is that, you know, 50 years ago, we were being left on doorstops, right? Or doorsteps. We don't have those elders because of things like eugenics and because of systemic pushes. I mean, it's why independent living exists, right? It's why Obergefell decision, which I may be mispronouncing, exists, right? Minimal barriers to living in community. My advice would be to look for those, you can call them elders with lived experience of disability, and then be able to have a clear conversation about where that intersects with your, say, child. And that may mean talking to people who aren't stereotypically understood as experts. I don't think that, I mean, I don't like the term expert to start off with. Let's start there as I blabber for an hour, right? I think expert is a term that, I mean, if somebody labels me, it's fine, but I think it's not one to take, and I'm hesitant of some folks who put expert first, because expert on what? Like, there's an argument to be made that my memory is so inconsistent with certain things that I'm not even an expert on my own lived experience in some ways, right? So, you know, do I remember what it was like to have CP at age one? I have photos. Is that helpful? No. You'd have to go into the little red book that has all the little, you know, things. John's first McDonald's, right? Literally written in mine, right? One of my teammates found that one day, by the way. That's very funny. But you know, go to the people I mentioned earlier, people within independent living centers. I've done some articles interviewing people there. I think that's a place to start. People who have done some of the legislative work. There's commissions existing in various states to do with these things, and really seek out, really be willing to ask the person, do you have lived experience with disability? And I think it's fair to say, because I'm inundated with the parent perspective, I'm inundated with the support perspective. I am I am under a mountain of what the OT thinks I should do. But what I want to do is talk to the person who, let's just say, you know, if my child, I don't have a kid, but like if my child's an AAC user, go talk to people. They're out there who are AAC users. There are public people on social media who, you know, are willing to talk about these things when you approach them respectfully and do all those sorts of things. And pay for their labor, please. If you're going to basically ask for a consultation, there are ways to navigate this that don't have to go along the stereotypical systems, because a lot of the stereotypical systems perpetuate what autism, what cerebral palsy, what spina bifida, what spinal cord injury, what, I mean, I mentioned Ehlers-Danlos. Like, there's these systems perpetuate the same things, and bringing us all the way back, they tend to put us in the two, you know, hero, tragic. The piece says we don't have the privilege of being boring. It's very difficult to talk about, you know, it's very difficult just even within the medical model to put, I mean, I get generalizing, but like there's such a spectrum within disability and within each individual disability. You know, I have friends, I would say my diagnosis sounds more like a Italian dish than a diagnosis, but cerebral palsy, spastic diplegia with a hint of ataxia. I always think the hint is very funny. Right? I'm actually a quad. They just couldn't figure that out when I was, you know, a week old, right? Fine. It's very easy to put it in a box and say, right, this is what CP is, right? But I have friends who are the same diagnosis as me and are using power chairs and, you know, if I was going to put it on Parasport spectrum, right? I'm playing wheelchair basketball, wheelchair rugby, sit skiing, and they're playing bocce, and that's cool, right? Yeah. Or they could play bocce. That's the understanding that I think listeners can take away, is that it's not that lived experience is the only experience, because I do think that parents need to be, I mean, not support groups, but need to be in spaces where they are affirmed and they have spaces where they can ask quote unquote silly questions. Because a silly question, and I don't know that questions are silly, maybe that's the wrong term to use, but questions that could have an offensive connotation simply because people don't know, how's that, can feel like they're preying on somebody's lived experience. And sometimes those things need to be said with, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here probably, but need to be said. And I think the second thing, if I may, I know I'm rambling again, Eric, so you get to cut parts that you don't like, I suppose, but is that I think parents with disabilities, parents, caregivers, support systems, and I've interviewed some folks about this, so I'm not a parent, so I'm not speaking from lived experience, but I think there is a uniqueness, I know we hate the word unique, but I think there is a uniqueness to unpacking one's own disability or disabling conditions, if somebody doesn't want to take the label, in the context of somebody they're supporting who has a disability, either the same or different from their own. And then I think that's another unspoken about place. So I'm glad we could talk about that today.
Well, that's awesome, John. Thank you. Yeah, and I'm working with a therapist now to unpack some of my own stuff. And, you know, I'm actually starting another podcast with Jennifer Fraser, the author of The Bullied Brain, to do some exploring into brain healing, the brain from trauma and stuff. And I love everything you're saying, and I appreciate the fact that you are giving parents permission to not have all the answers, but also to be willing to, you know, it's overused, there's no such thing as a stupid question, but you know, sometimes those questions, to your point, can seem offensive.
And it's about an audience.
Yeah.
It's about an audience. If I wanted to ask I think about it in terms of reporting. If I don't know an answer to a question around how to frame a disability, even though I'm a disabled reporter, if I don't know, say, for example, I don't know for sure, identity first versus person first is a bad example because you just ask them. But, oh, here's a good one, right? Say I'm unsure as to whether a word that is used in Britain for a certain disability is used here, right? We saw this with spaz and spastic being used in some songs, and a lot of Americans talking about it, and I was born in Britain. I mean, the SCOPE, the biggest disability organization, used to be called the Spastic Society until like 1994, right? This is a word that exists and has been used. But if I didn't know that and I wanted to, I need to be comfortable enough to not know that. And it's scary as all get up to be vulnerable enough to say, I don't know this. And I need to go to people who do rather than freewheeling it and hoping and getting a multitude of perspectives. I think, again, I talked earlier about, you know, the history of disability advocacy being very white. I think the time has come for us to understand that we need to broaden that out a lot and that it can be an intersectional understanding of disability.
I agree. So I found you because of the opinion article you wrote for CBC titled "Let Us Be Boring: Disabled People Are More Than Heroes or Objects of Your Pity." Where can people find more about? Where can people do you have a standard column that I can link to? We know that you're at Crippled and Creative on Twitter. I'll make sure I link that.
Oh, sure. So that's just in my Twitter bio. My actual Twitter is go me. Didn't know I was going to become a journalist when I made my Twitter handle unpronounceable to most people. But my Twitter handle is @CYMRU, which is Wales in Welsh, Cymru, _ET_Canada.
Wow.
I am Welsh and Canadian. I don't know why I was feeling patriotic at like age 12, but there you go. People can find me. That series, that article that you reference, is part of a broader series called Taking a Sitting Stand, which is both video and written and is captioned. I've got to give kudos to the production team at CBC, including Natasha Lipney, Jamie, and Matt Duguid, who did a lot of work on that. And a host of other people. I'm very lucky that I get to work with them. And then if you want a broader look at my portfolio, my website is jlepke.com.
So J, and then just your last name.
Just my last name, yeah, .com. And then the portfolio is /portfolio, but it's fairly easy to find if one wants to.
And you'd be willing, if another podcaster wanted to have you on the podcast, come talk, you're open to that. And
yeah, I mean, I co-host one.
Do you? What's your podcast?
I do. So I co-host one with my good friend and colleague, Dr. Andrew Colombo Dogvito, who teaches at the University of North Texas. And he invited me on to co-host his podcast, which is called Disability Movement, Etc. And I'll send you a link for that. Awesome. But we talk about disability from movement in terms of parasport and disability and adaptive rec and that sort of sphere, but also disability as a social movement.
Very cool. No, John, this has been awesome. I'm glad I took because I didn't know where this pod. Usually I do a lot of research. And I'm like, okay, this is where I want to steer the conversation. But this was really, I need somebody I can bounce my ideas off of because I'm who is more in the space than I am. Like I'm in the space as a parent and I guess I get kind of an advocate. I don't really see myself as an advocate either because I have an overinflated sense of justice, that's all it is. It's more about the justice than it is about any one particular disability or otherwise. It's just this. It doesn't have to be equal, but it has to be right. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think we have this assumption, even within disability community, like self-advocacy skills are important. Certainly, I wouldn't exist without self-advocacy skills. I was taught from family and friends, etc., but also from parasport. Parasport has many foibles. I would still not be the person I am today without those experiences. Many of them complicated. What I will say is that self-advocacy can't be the one and only thing. And I think sometimes it gets framed. And I'm not saying you're framing it this way, but it often gets framed as like the silver bullet, that if we teach somebody to advocate, then all ills will be solved. And actually that just absolves an ableist society from fixing its shit. Right? And at some point we need some balance. So I think people come to, personally speaking, I think people need to come to their own understandings of what advocate or activist can mean. And when it's okay and when it's needed to take a step back from sort of the front line of advocacy, like it's okay to retreat to only say you only feel comfortable in disability-led spaces. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we just need to be mindful of how inclusion can involve those rest periods, can resist capitalism as well as ableism, and actually allow us times to build in community. Don't worry, I'm not suddenly going to go off on some leftist diatribe, although you did ask a British Canadian to come ramble, but I think that's the other piece of advice, is that rest is important. And certainly the Salo people who are active in these spaces don't tend to get as much rest as I wish they would in all senses of the word. And I think that's true for allyship and support systems as well. Rest can take many forms.
And I think that's the perfect place to end this, is rest is important. It's certainly something that I think a lot of people talk about, but very few execute. John, thank you very much it was a bit of a rambling conversation. So listeners, if you're still listening, thank you. But I enjoyed
it. That's my fault.
I really did. Thanks for listening to the conversation I had with John. I hope you found it helpful. I'm going to include links to his portfolio and his Twitter and social media handle in the show notes. He's a very learned man. He is a journalist, so he does do a lot of research. I enjoyed the conversation. It was different for me. At times, I admit, I wasn't really sure where I was going to go. I feel maybe I could have done a little more prep, but I really wanted to explore my ideas, and I didn't want to go in beating the drum saying these are my beliefs, this is what I'm not going to change my mind. I wanted to go in with my beliefs held loosely, so I would be more receptive for when he pushed back or when he brought things up that I hadn't considered. And I feel like that was accomplished. And now I have a lot to sit with and reflect on. But I hope you enjoyed it as well. Thanks for listening.